Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back to the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, and I have a special guest co-host. It's Kevin Thompson from The Buzz on Z-Talk Radio. Hey, Kev, how you doing?
Hey, I am doing great, Al. Thanks for having me aboard.
Oh, it's always good to have you. Do you remember the Martha Moxie murders?
You know, yes, and in fact, I do. It's been a long time ago, but I hear here recently it's hot news.
Well, Martha Moxley was 15 and was bludgeoned to death with a golf club in the affluent Greenwich, Connecticut neighborhood. Now, no one was charged with her murder until 2002, when Michael Skakel, who was Moxley's neighbor, who was also 15 at the time of the murder, was tried and convicted of the crime. And joining us today will be Robert F. Kennedy, Jr., who is the cousin of Michael Skakel, who says he was framed for the murder of Martha Moxley. Robert was named one of Time magazine's Heroes of the Planet and was an assistant district attorney in New York City. And it's our pleasure to welcome Robert to the House of Mystery. Thank you for joining us on the show.
I'm glad to be here.
What made you decide to write the book about this?
Well, my cousin Michael Skakel was 15 years old when the murder was committed in 1975. 27 years later, he was never a suspect for 25 years. 27 years later, he was convicted of the crime with no physical evidence based upon the perjured testimony of two supposed confession witnesses. He then served 11 and a half years in prison, and he was released 3 years ago after a habeas corpus petition based upon the fact that he had ineffective counsel. His lawyer, who actually went to jail immediately after Michael went to jail, for taking the money that he was supposed to spend in the trial, spending it on personal accounts and not paying tax. Michael really never got a defense. But this cloud has been hanging over him and his family for many years. And during the course of my investigation, I've not only uncovered this evidence that the confessions were perjured, and that the corrupt police officer was obsessed with convicting Michael Skakel and committed many other crimes in order to convict him, but I also found the identity of the true murderers. And I was able to track them down and to interview. And those interviews were in this book.
Wow, that's amazing. Can you say who you figured the murderer was?
There were two murderers. One is named Adolf Hasbrook, and he lives in Bridgeport, Connecticut. The other's name is Burton Kinsley, and he lives in Portland, Oregon.
What was it that gave them away? How is it that you found them?
Well, immediately after Michael's conviction shocked his family. It shocked me, and I went, because I knew that he was innocent. I wrote an article about his conviction that showed that he could not possibly have committed the crime. He was 11 miles away with six eyewitnesses at the place he was, and eight more witnesses who saw him left, saw him return. I wrote this article for the Atlantic Monthly, which was an award-winning article. Soon after that, I received a letter from a classmate of Michael Skakel's who I had never heard of before, named Crawford Mills, and he told me in this letter, he said the jury got it wrong, and he revealed that another classmate, a man named Tony Bryant, who had been a classmate of Michael's and Crawford for 2 years, had been present the night of the murder with the murderers, and knew that none of the Skakels had been involved in the crime, and knew the people who committed it. I was able then to track down Tony Bryant in Florida. Tony Bryant is a first cousin of NBA Lakers star Kobe Bryant. And his brother, Tony's Bryant, a brother, plays for the Mavericks. He comes from a very prominent African-American. His mother is a Oscar-winning film producer. And he went to school with Michael for 2 years. And then he moved back with his mother in New York City, and went to a public school. And while he was in the public school, he met two city boys who he befriended. These were large kids. They were a year older than their classmate. He knew them only as Adolf and Burr. They were 6'3" and 6'4", respectively, 250 pounds, and very strong ass. They were capable of committing this murder, which had a savagery. And Michael would not have been capable of. He was 120 pounds at that time. He was a shrimp. He had 28-inch weight. Tony took the two boys to Greenwich on six occasions. And during those occasions, they saw Martha Moxley, who was the victim of the murder eventually. And Adolf developed an obsession with her. And he talked about her constantly. They returned for Mischief Night, which was the night before Halloween. And on the train on the way up from the city, they planned the assault. He said that they were going to go caveman on a Greenwich girl, and according to Tony, dragging her into the bushes, striking her with the club, and then sexually assaulting. The following Monday, the three boys went onto the Skakel property and picked up golf clubs that were lying there. And they said to each other, now we have our caveman club. Tony got nervous because he knew that they were going to do something very dangerous. And he left 20 minutes before the murder. That was Friday. On Monday, the boys saw him again and confessed that they had murdered, that they had committed the murder. Tony also spoke with a young kid named Jeffrey Byrne, whose house the two men stayed in the night of the murder and cleaned the blood off their clothes and their bodies. And Jeffrey Byrne, who was traumatized by the incident and subsequently died in a mysterious death, complained constantly to Tony about what had happened as a result of Tony's actions. Tony's mother told him she was very aware of the racial landscape at that time. Greenwich had a notoriously racist police department. And she said, you brought these two boys up there. He told her that they had murdered Martha. She said, you brought these two boys up there. You are black. If you come forward with this, you are going to be implicated and may spend the rest of your life in jail. You can never talk about this murder again. And you have to separate yourself from Adolf and Burr. He did that. And he went away to school. His mother immediately sent him away to school in Texas. I finally reached him. And when I got a hold of him, he said to me, I said, I'm Robert F. Kennedy Jr. I am a cousin of Michael Skakel, and I want to talk to you about the Martha Moxley murder. And there was a long pause on the other end of the line, and then he said, I've been waiting 27 years for this telephone. And it was that call and six subsequent calls he sold me in taped conversation. Exactly what had happened, the entire story. So I then was able to, he only knew Adolf and Berger by their nickname. I was able to obtain a yearbook from Charles Evans Hughes High School and determine that Adolf was Adolf Hasbrook, that Berger was Bert Kempis. I was able to track those two men down and have conversations with them, in which they admitted that they had been in Greenwich that night. And they admitted that they had been in the home of Jeffrey Byrne, the boy who helped them clean off after the murder. And they described with the intricate details the interior of that home. I then tracked down mountains of other corroborative evidence, including the fact that on Martha's body were found two hairs that nobody was ever able to explain. One of them was described as negroid, and the other was described as Asian-like, and Adolf is African-American, and Burr is Caucasian, and is described as either part Asian or part American. There was no hairs or any other evidence found that resembled anything to do with connected Michael to the crime. There was lots and lots of other evidence that corroborates Tommy's story of what really happened that month.
So are you confident that Michael will receive a new trial, or?
No, I'm not. You have a lot of entrenched interest, and Al can tell you that once a law enforcement system has a conviction by a jury, they're very, very reluctant. Prosecutors are very reluctant to admit they're wrong or to let go of the convicted person, so that the state has appealed the decision by the judge that released Michael. And that decision is now before a 6-judge panel of the Connecticut Supreme Court. If those judges deny the lower court decision, Michael will go back to prison and serve his 25-year to life sentence, to serve out the sentence. If they uphold the lower court, then the state of Connecticut has to make a decision about whether they're going to re-prosecute Michael or whether they will prosecute for the first time the real killers of Michael Moxley.
Now, why, in the face of all of this, Robert, why would they be hesitant? I mean, you just presented, this is a revelation to us, because before we came on the air, Al and I were discussing this case at length, and we thought we had it, you know, kind of tied up with Littleton. But this is a revelation.
The truth is that almost nothing the public heard about this crime was true. And there's a lot about what happened that nobody knew about it, that I didn't know about, that I didn't even suspect. The way, for example, that Michael was framed, the framing was really orchestrated by the police, by the disgraced New York or L.A. police, former L.A. police detective Mark Furman, who played this pivotal role in the O.J. acquittal. He then came to Greenwich and played a pivotal role in the conviction of an innocent man. He was working surreptitiously with a man named Tom Sheridan, whose name has never been mentioned before in connection to this crime, but Sheridan was an in-house paper lawyer and advisor whose entire career had been spent inside the Skakel family. He was secretly nursing a seething resentment toward the Skakels, and he was feeding false information about the Skakels to their enemies, Detective Frank Garr, who was the crooked police officer, and to other people who were opposed to the Skakel interest. And I show all that for the first time in this book, how the conspiracy to frame Michael was orchestrated and carried out.
Robert, now this evidence, I know this is probably going to sound like a stupid question, but have you presented this to the attorneys and to the police?
Crawford Mills, who brought the evidence to me, had first brought it to Detective Garr and to the prosecutor. But since it did not implicate Michael Skakel, and since it exculpated him, they ignored it. He then went to Michael's attorney, Mickey Sherman, who essentially did nothing to defend Michael and never investigated it and never told Michael about it. So they had reason to know and had the same lead that I was able to exploit to determine who really killed Martha, but they didn't want to know that, as I show in the book. They weren't interested in any evidence that put anybody on the gibbet except for Michael Skaper.
That is a shame. Because, you know, I work in law enforcement, and thinking, thinking as an investigator or as an officer, I would be definitely interested in this type of information.
Of course you would. And, you know, I work in law enforcement myself. I was a prosecutor, and, you know, most prosecutors are honest, and they do what they're supposed to do, which what their legal duty requires them to do, which is that not to put somebody in jail, but to see that justice is done. That's the unique duty of a prosecutor in this country. Other right. countries have mandatory prosecution. Anybody the police brings to a prosecutor, they must prosecute. But in this country, the prosecutor is supposed to stand as a baffle against the winds of public passions and prejudice and police enthusiasm. Oh, but that didn't happen in this case. And as you know, prosecutors have all kinds of ways of putting their thumbs on the scale of justice. And it's very easy for a prosecutor to sway a jury, particularly in notorious crimes like this one, infamous crimes where there's a public demand for blood or a public demand for justice. And in this case, you had a prosecutor, you had a corrupt police officer who was running the investigation and trial, and you had a prosecutor who had, with elastic ethics and huge overweening ambition, who saw this as a career case and who was determined to jail Michael, even though the evidence against him was obviously fabricated. And in the end, he used an audiovisual display that swayed the jury despite the fact that nobody could ever explain how Michael Skakel could have committed this crime when he was 11 miles away with 15 witnesses to his absence that night from anywhere near Belhaven.
Correct, because they were dropping a family member off.
His brother, Rush Skakel, who attended Dartmouth, had gone to a early audience test preview in Dartmouth, Massachusetts, or Dartmouth, New Hampshire, of the British football comedy Monty Python's Flying Circus, which had never been shown in the United States. They saw it in a theater, and that night it was being played on TV, American TV, for the first time. Rush picked up two of his brothers and a cousin, and they went to the house of other cousins, the Tarion family, to see that show. And that show ran from 10:30 to 11 o'clock, from 10 to 10:30, and the murder took place at 10. They had left at 9:30. They were all there. They all saw each other, and there were non-family members there, too, who saw Michael, who was never interviewed by Michael's attorney, a perfect ironclad alibi. You know, that's one of the reasons the judge released Michael, is because he said, you know, the attorney never even spoke to the key alibi witness.
Why do you think that Tommy and Michael changed their testimony so many times, like their story about what was happening?
Well, Michael changed his story once, and Tommy changed his story once. And, one of the things that I show in this book is every single suspect changed their story multiple times, and every single witness. Because you're talking about a crime that was 30 years old, people don't remember what they were 30 years ago. Penny Littleton changed his story 6 times. John Moxley, the victim's brother, who was also a suspect, changed his story 5 times. His alibi was completely different in the end from what it had been in the beginning. Andrea Shakespeare, all of these.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Other witnesses changed their testimony, but Michael and Tommy had very compelling reasons to change their testimony. Tommy said that, originally testified, he said goodbye to Martha at 9:30. He had gone out and made out with her in the bushes, and they had mutually masturbated. So this was something that no 17-year-old kid would want to share with adults, and he was asked about what he was doing. That's concrete and hardened on that story before anybody knew that Martha was murdered. So, you know, he had told that story 3 times to people who were looking for Martha before her body was found. So that was the story he stuck with until 15 years later, when he was no longer scared of his puritanical, authoritarian, and very violent father, who was, obsessed with sexual sin. Tommy wasn't going to talk about that, and, you know, he and Michael had the same issue. Michael had been masturbating in a tree, and, you know, he was horny. He just turned 15. He was a horny little kid. That doesn't make him a murderer. But who would talk about that? Even Jay Leno said that most Americans would rather be convicted of murder than to admit to having masturbated and betrayed.
Yeah.
No kid would talk about that kind of stuff. And most kids 14 years old aren't masturbating and doing crazy stuff. But it doesn't make you a murderer. But it's understandable that they didn't tell the story the first time around. But Michael had been telling that story after he got sober. In 1982, Michael was very open about that story with everybody and consistently told the exact same story for 20 years.
What's your thoughts then on Ken Littleton and about all of his escapades and him failing the lie detector test and the way he talked about it?
Ken Littleton was a much stronger suspect than Michael. He was connected to 20 other serial murders that almost all involved one girl the same age as Martha. He failed 5 separate lie detector tests. He appeared on several occasions but confessed to the crime. He was in and out of prison, in and out of mental institutions. He really undertook a criminal career immediately after the murder. And he had a history of violence towards women. So he was a very, very strong suspect. But And the evidence against him was far stronger and very compelling. I mean, he was everybody's suspect for most of those years, but in order to prosecute, they didn't want him to prosecute. Mark, he was of no use to Mark Furman. Because Mark Furman, in order to sell his books, needed a famous person to be on the gibbet. And Kenny Littleton wasn't. He couldn't have sold one book by saying it was Kenny Littleton. The only way to sell books is to accuse Michael Skakel and then brand Michael Skakel as a Kennedy cousin, which, you know, Michael Skakel is not a Kennedy. I never knew Michael Skakel growing up. No Kennedy knew him. I didn't meet Michael Skakel until 1983, which was 8 years after the crime was committed. I never heard of the Martha Moxley murder. None of my brothers and sisters were aware of this, and none of us knew any of the Skakels. My family, as I show in the book, was estranged from the Skakel family. The Skakels were carbon, oil, and coal Republicans who supported Nixon in 1960, Kenneth Keating over my father in the Senate race in 64, and opposed my father's senatorial bid in 1968. And, you know, my mother loved her brothers and sisters, but she had no contact with them, and we never met any of the Skakel cousins, as I said, until 8 years after murder was committed.
Wow. Yeah, that's kind of a surprise. I didn't realize that, because they make it sound like you guys all grew up together and knew each other.
Yeah, no, we didn't. Of course, that's what, you know, that was part of the flypaper of this case that kind of, you know, attracted the feckless national media. Nobody looked below those seductive orthodoxies, you know, beyond this kind of thin patina to actually look at the fact. This was a story that in journalistic parlance was too good to fact check. Nobody, there were 401 reporters certified to cover this case, and only one of them questioned that orthodoxy and said, wait a second, this doesn't make any sense.
Now, do you feel like there's going to be some sort of issue with being that with minority tensions right now about accusing them too?
Well, the people who I accuse and who committed the crime, one of them is African-American and one is Caucasian. I can't be responsible for optics. My only choice is to pursue the truth. That's what journalists should be doing. That's what the kind of lawyer that I am does. That's what most of us try to do, which is to pursue the truth. Oh, and I really don't see that I have any choice other than to pursue the truth wherever it leads.
Now that brings up a really good point, Robert. If you don't mind me asking, you know, the Kennedys were a big name. Well, they still are. Do you feel that the police were soft-handed on them because of their power and their authority? I mean, do you think that they actually did the job? Did they do the searches? Did they go in depth enough?
No, as has been shown time and time again, first of all, there was no Kennedy involved in this murder. Well, the Kennedys were unaware of this murder. It wasn't something that anybody in my family ever talked to. I had never heard about it until 8 years later. Did the Skakels have political power? No, none. Was a fix in somehow? No. And even the biggest critics, Frank Gar and Len Levitt, have said that is absolute nonsense, that there was no fix. There was just extraordinary police incompetence. There was 147 people, men on the Greenwich police force, and not one of them had ever been involved in a murder investigation. They didn't have police tape. They lost everything. They lost stuff that would have exculpated the Skakel kids. They lost the vaginal swabs. They lost the anal swabs. They didn't do proper testing to detect the presence of a sexual assault. They lost all the hairs that were found on Martha's body. They lost a bloody pair of pants size 36, which would have fit those boys or Kenny Littleton. Michael had a 28-inch waist. They lost a bloody pair of size 13 sneakers. Michael had a size 6 foot at that time. So, you know, there was a lot of police incompetence, and it goes on and on and on. It's detailed in the book. It had nothing to do with anybody fixing the police. They were just, you know, they were just incompetent.
So, given the...
They lost, and I, you know, among other things, they lost the handle to the golf club, which, when the police first arrived, they reported that it was protruding from off his neck. Afterwards, nobody could explain. I think it appears that somebody just took it as a souvenir. It never ended up in the police locker.
Now,
both the doctor, the first doctor on the site, and the police, the two first policemen, reported being there, and the camera, the photographs confirmed that. But, you know, it was lost, and then at the trial, John Benedict, the prosecutor, told the jury that Michael Skakel had taken it, but no evidence of that, in order to conceal his mother's name on the handle. He said no other murderer would have had an incentive to take it, ignoring the whole science of fingerprint detection. Of course, anybody would have had the incentive, but he also ignored the evidence that the police, that it had been there when Mars's body was found, that the police had lost it.
Yeah, that's Robert, that's a revelation to me, because it was our understanding that the handle was missing completely from the scene. So you're saying that the police lost all of this evidence?
Yes. The two first police officer on the scene, you know, Detective Hickman or Officer Hickman, both testified then and subsequently that the handle was there when they arrived with it, that the handle was protruding from Martha's neck with a leather grip, quote-unquote. The doctor, first doctor to arrive on the site, said that handle by that time was laying next to Martha's head on the ground, and it was never recovered. The police just lost it.
I mean, we have not heard any of this, have we, Al?
No, it's all... Out of all the reading and stuff we did.
Oh, read the book, guys, because, you know, I think on almost every page of that book, you're going to see things that you haven't seen before, and I don't ask anybody to take my opinion seriously about what happened. They shouldn't do that. You know, this whole, the big pitfall of this case is nobody has ever looked at the facts. They followed passion and prejudice. Nobody has followed the facts. And if you look at the facts, there's no way that Michael could have committed the crime, and the corruption in the Detective Guard's office is, you know, should put him in jail. He should be in prison for this, for what he did. And then you'll also see the strong evidence, and which I think is beyond a reasonable doubt. Other people may not think it's that beyond a reasonable doubt, but I believe it is, that Adolph and Burr killed her. And when we tried to subpoena Adolph and Burr, they both took the Fifth Amendment. Mm-hmm. I've said, you know, publicly that if I'm wrong about Adolph and Burr, they should sue me. If they're innocent, they will. I don't believe that's going to happen.
Do you think they'll ever get prosecuted then for this?
I hope so. If they're, you know, Connecticut is supposed to be the Constitution state. These guys should be in jail.
If they did it, I agree. But Robert, if I may, can I challenge you on just a couple of things?
Sure.
To put this in perspective? Let's go back to the handle. Now, what evidence do you have that somebody may have taken it? Do you know that it was there on the scene other than just reports?
I don't know, because I wasn't there. I just know what the two police officers say to this day. You know, Detective Hickman, who was the first on the scene, says not only was it there, he describes in the police report it being there with its other leatherette grip. And he also has said, I went home and I told my wife at night. The sight of the protruding from his neck disturbed him. And the other detective on site, the first on site, said the same thing. The doctor, the first doctor on the site, who declared her dead, wanted her dead, except by that time the handle was lying next to her head on the blanket.
Ah, I understand. Because from my research looking at this case, the autopsy report said that there were several strikes to her head. I mean, they were very damaging blows. That so much to the point that they couldn't tell which one it was that actually was the cause of death. But obviously, a golf club handle protruding from the neck would have been the cause of death. Why would they not have said that?
They believe the coroner reports all mention the punctures in her throat that were made by a golf club shaft.
Mm-hmm.
So that is, you know, that's in every coroner report, police report. The question is, what happened to the piece? The golf club was broken in three pieces.
Yes.
What happened to the piece, which was the handle part, and made those, you know, that made those impalements? And what the police officers who were first on site say, and the doctor, was it was there at the time that they arrived.
Yes, sir. And because I'm personally, and this is just us guys talking, personally, I still like Littleton for it, because he even made the statement at one point to one, you know, his wife, that if they ever find that golf club handle, my prints are going to be on it.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of people are going to have different theories about this case, but what I would ask you to do is to read the book. And then let's talk about it, because I don't think that until you see the facts, I don't think that, you know, that anybody can make any rational conclusions about this case. It's all guesswork, and that's what it's been up to this time.
Yes.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. We really recommend everybody pick up the book. It's on sale now, isn't it?
Yeah, the book is on sale. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or, you know, it should be in your local bookstore.
Again, the book is called Framed, Why Michael Skakel Spent Over a Decade in Prison for a Murder He Didn't Commit. The guest and author, Robert F. Kennedy, Jr., thank you very much for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Robert, it's been an honor to speak with you. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure, and I'm very grateful for the attention that you've given me. You're actually interested in the facts rather than pathology. Thank you.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.